Tonight we're looking at John chapter 18, beginning in verse 12. Last week we began with verse 1, going through verse 11, and looked at Jesus' betrayal and arrest in the garden. Beginning with verse 12, going through verse 27, what John does is he puts two things together. He shares with us Jesus' beginning of his trials before Annas, and also the betrayal, or not the betrayal, the denial, the three denials by Peter. And if you read this section, you'll notice that what he does is he kind of weaves them together, because he starts with Jesus before Annas, and then while that is going on inside, he comes out into the courtyard and shares with us what's going on with Peter in the courtyard. And then he takes us back inside to what's happening before Annas again, and then finally back out to the courtyard for Peter's last two betrayals or denials of our Lord, and then what happens right at the end. And please don't miss that, because it makes you stop and think. But what we have, first of all, is Jesus being brought before Annas right here in verses 12 through 14. And as John presents it to us, he says, talks about the Roman cohort and the commander and the officers of the Jews, the fact that they had arrested Jesus, bound him, led him to Annas first, for he, as he says, was the father-in-law of Caiaphas, who was high priest that year. He says, now Caiaphas was the one who had advised the Jews that it was expedient for one man to die on behalf of the people. So what John does is he reminds us yet again of who's involved in the arrest of Jesus. He mentions the Roman cohort, as we spoke about last week, and their commander. If you remember last week, I shared with you that a cohort under Roman law, or as the structure of the Roman military, could be as many as 1,000 men, 760 foot soldiers, 240 cavalry, and then what was called the chiliarch, the commander that led them. Or it could be as few as 200, which was called a maniple. In between that was another number, 600. So somewhere between, probably closer to the 200 number, we don't know for sure, but somewhere in that range were the number of Roman soldiers who came out that night with what he calls the officers of the Jews. This would have been the temple guard, if you will, the security police for the temple. These were the ones who made sure that things at the temple happened in a calm way. But now here's the thing that's interesting. It's something that only John mentions, and that is the fact that Jesus is first brought before Annas. What is the significance in all of that? Well, here is what, if we look kind of outside of Scripture, what we find, and that is that Annas was high priest from 6 AD up to 15 AD. And at that point, he was deposed by the governor at that time of the Romans, the man who would precede Pontius Pilate, a man by the name of Valerius Gratus. Now, if you remember your Old Testament, the high priest was appointed for a lifetime. High priests were not replaced until they died. But under the Roman rule, Romans did not like for a single individual to have all of the power, for it to be concentrated in that individual. So they were known for frequently changing out the high priest. And what we know is that Annas continued to hold enormous influence in Jerusalem and over the religious sphere. Here's why. First of all, it is the fact that most of the Jews understood what the law taught. It doesn't matter what Rome does, Annas, according to God, is still the high priest. And so they still looked to him for his judgments. And he still had influence because of that. The second thing is that no fewer than five of his sons and his son-in-law, Caiaphas, held the office of high priest at one time or other. So he was like the one who was over it. His influence continued through his sons and through his son-in-law, Caiaphas. And so it is through him that there is still a lot of direction as far as what is happening. If you look in Luke's gospel, even Luke brings this out, because in chapter 3 of his gospel, there in verse 2, he tells us that the high priest, that John the Baptist began his ministry during the high priesthood of Annas and Caiaphas. So it was while these were, Annas was still considered high priest, but Caiaphas was the one that had been appointed. And John reminds us of something else right here. It was in that same year, if you go back to John chapter 7 or 11, verse 50, you find that Caiaphas had advised the Jews that it was expedient for one man to die on behalf of the nation, speaking of Jesus. He prophesied, not realizing what he was prophesying. Now, while that is going on inside, he takes us outside, verses 15 through 18. And what we find is this. Simon Peter was following Jesus, and so was another disciple. And he tells us that that disciple was known to the high priest and entered with Jesus into the court of the high priest, but Peter was standing outside at the door. So the other disciple, who was known to the high priest, went out, spoke to the doorkeeper, and brought Peter in. Now, let me stop there. As I said, John transitions what's happening outside in the courtyard. And what he's doing, he is connecting this courtyard, if you will, connects the residence of Annas with the residence of Caiaphas. And Peter and another disciple that John does not name were following Jesus and the party that had arrested him, perhaps at a distance. Now, what John says is that this is an individual that the high priest knew, but he doesn't name him. The most logical choice, and the one that has been accepted by many down through the centuries, is that this individual is John, the beloved disciple, because he also doesn't name him himself in that capacity. But anyway, and John seems to be the one most likely. And I'm going to just accept it as John, but John is able to get in. But then he looks back, or he realizes maybe Peter calls to him, but Peter is still outside at the gate. So John, because he was known to the high priest and had entered the court of the high priest, he sees Peter stand at the door. He goes back and he speaks to the doorkeeper and says, "He's with me," something like that, and gets Peter in. Well, this doorkeeper is referred to as a servant girl or a slave girl. And as we read on there, we find that the slave girl who kept the door said to Peter, "You're not also one of this man's disciples, are you?" He said, "I am not." Now the slaves and the officers were standing there having made a charcoal fire, for it was cold. He says they were warming themselves, and Peter was also outside standing and warming himself. So she asked Peter this rhetorical question when he comes in. And the rhetorical question is, "You're not also one of this man's disciples." Now, the fact that she uses the word "also" indicates something else. She knows that John is a disciple of Jesus. She knew enough, and he was well known enough by the servants and those within the high priest household, that she could ask him, "Are you also one of his disciples?" Earlier that evening, John records Peter back in chapter 13, verse 37, as saying to Jesus, "Lord, why can I not follow you now? I will lay down my life for you." And after Jesus told Peter that he would deny him three times before the rooster crowed, Mark and Matthew both record Peter as saying to Jesus, "Even if I have to die with you, I will not deny you." And yet, when this young woman asked him this question, "You're not also one of this man's disciples, are you?" Peter said, "I am not." Denial number one. But don't be too quick to condemn Peter. And I'll tell you in a moment why. It's cold that night. John gives us that little detail. And because it's cold, several of them had built a little charcoal fire. They were gathering around it, warming themselves. You know where Peter ends up? Right there in the crowd, standing with them. It's interesting that John makes that comment. He went over, stood by them, and was warming himself as well. Well, now, John takes us back inside to what's going on with Annas. In verses 19 and 20, we see this question that Annas poses to him about two things, two specific subjects. His teaching, or his disciples and his teaching. And he tells us And here's what he says. He asked about his disciples. Possibly he's asking, how many do you have? How many are following you? And not only that, he's trying to figure out, is there any possibility of a conspiracy here? Is there anything I should be worried about? The second thing is about his teaching. And because of Jesus' claim and who he was to be, they remembered back in John chapter 8 when he said before Abraham was born, I am. They knew what that meant. Not only that, they had themselves spoken of the fact that they believed that Jesus was leading people astray. And in John chapter 7, there were those that were saying he is a good man, but others were saying, no, on the contrary, he leads the people astray. So there were these theological questions they had about him. And Matthew tells us in his gospel that when the Jewish religious leaders bring Jesus before them, before Pilate, that is, it was obvious to Pilate that the only reason they were trying Jesus is because they were envious of him. They were jealous of him. And he knew, as Matthew says in chapter 27, verse 18, that they'd hand him over to Pilate out of envy. What is it they were jealous of? Three things. They were jealous of Jesus' prestige, of his popularity, and his power. You see, here's the thing about Annas. Annas cared more about his own power and position over the people. And he was fearful that if Jesus was allowed to live, he would lose that. Here's something that was known. Remember when Jesus overturned the money changers in the temple? That had a certain name to it that the Jews of that day knew. It was called Annas Bazaar. And the reason for that was because you were not allowed to bring, you remember the law taught, you could not bring anything to be sacrificed, whether it was a lamb or a young bullock or anything like that, with any kind of defect. God would not accept it. So they had people inside the temple that when you came from outside, let's say you were coming from Nazareth or you were coming from some other place, either in Judea or Galilee, and you were coming to the temple for your sacrifice, you had your own animal, you'd brought it all the way from home, they would inspect that animal. Oh, here's a defect on this sheep. You can't use this. God will not permit it. The law does not permit it. You've got to buy one of ours. Outside, you could buy it for one price. Inside the temple precincts in Annas Bazaar, you had to pay 20 times as much. That's why one of the reasons that Jesus said, you've made my house a house of merchandise. That's why he overturned the money changers' tables and became so angry. Zeal for my Father's house has consumed me. You see, Annas liked his power and he wanted to keep it. He wanted to keep his position. Now, in all of this, if you'll notice, Jesus doesn't say anything about his disciples. He's protecting them. And he also lets Annas know that there's no need for him to really question Jesus concerning his teaching. And he tells him why. He says, I've spoken nothing in secret. He tells him there, I've spoken openly to the world. I always taught in the synagogues and in the temple where all the Jews come together. So what's the point? The point is this. Thousands have heard me teach. And you can ask any one of those and they'll tell you everything I've ever said to them. If you want to know what I've taught, go to them. The hearing that they are conducting was illegal for several reasons. But one of the main reasons was because, according to the Old Testament, Jesus, like anyone else, was to be considered absolutely innocent until two or three witnesses were brought, given testimony, and then that testimony was investigated and it could be confirmed, and then they could bring charges against him. You see, you went to the witnesses first. And even under Jewish law, you went to the witnesses that were for the defendant before you went to the witnesses that were against the defendant. So what have they done? They've already fabricated their charges. And what they have decided is that we're going to try him. We already know him. We want him to be guilty. So they're doing that. So if you look at verses 21 through 24, what Jesus does in these verses is to challenge the legality of this entire escapade, his interrogation. Look at what he says. Why do you question me? Question those who have heard what I spoke to them. They know what I said. And we had said this, one of the officers standing nearby struck him, saying, is that the way you answer the high priest? Now let me stop there for just a moment. Under the Old Testament law, even as under our own system of jurisdiction, our own laws, an individual cannot be compelled to testify against him or herself. And that is what Annas is seeking to try to force Jesus to do, to testify against himself. And Jesus rightly refuses to respond to this kind of questioning, even challenges it. And so what happens? One of the officers standing nearby slaps him on the face. Now I want you to think about one thing. Just let me chase a rabbit for a minute. As I was putting this lesson together, that just made me stop and think. Is there anywhere else in the Gospels that you find before this point in time Jesus being physically assaulted? Anywhere. I can't find it. I can't think of it. Maybe you can. But let me ask you a question. Can you imagine the restraint that he had to use at that moment in time? Folks, this is the one that flooded the entire world and saved 8 souls through an ark. This is the one who destroyed an entire generation of babies in Egypt on one single night. This is the one who destroyed an Egyptian army, drowning them in a sea. And you can go on and on with what he can do just through speaking the word. And yet he did not open his mouth in order to strike back or to call anything to happen. Remember what he had said to the disciples in the garden? Put your sword away. Do you not know that I can ask my Father and he will put at my disposal 12 legions of angels, 72,000? But he doesn't lash back. What restraint? And then not just that, what about the angels? The angels who can see what's going on. And God perhaps says, no, you do not. I know what I'm doing. And what does Jesus do? He doesn't back down. What Jesus does is he responds. And his response to Annas is basically, listen, if what I have said to you is illegal or if it's inappropriate, then file the appropriate charges of contempt with the court. Testify, as he says, of the wrong. And yet, if I'm speaking the truth, and this is what he says, if rightly, why do you strike me? You see, his challenge is against the illegality of the interrogation. And he says, if I'm right, why are you assaulting me? And through his response, what Jesus is saying is, give me a fair trial, which he knows is not going to take place. You see, his opponents are unable, and they know they are. They are unable to win their case by fair means, so they are content to pursue any unjust means they can come up with. And that's what they're doing here. And realizing that he isn't going anywhere with this questioning of Jesus, what Annas does is has him bound up. Now remember, when they first arrested him in the garden, they brought him bound to Annas. Apparently during the questioning, he is unbound because now Annas has him bound and sent over to Caiaphas. If Jesus is to be brought to Pilate with charges filed against him, it has to be done through the one whom Pilate recognizes as the high priest. That's Caiaphas. So he has him sent to Caiaphas. Back outside, verse 25. Now, why is John moving us back and forth? Because John is making a contrast. He is making a contrast between the way that Jesus replies to his accusers and the way Peter keeps denying that he knows Jesus. A man by the name of R.E. Brown, in a commentary on this passage, said this. He says, Jesus stands up to his questioners and denies nothing. Peter cowers before his questioners and denies everything. And as Peter is standing there warming himself by the fire, one of those standing there with him asked the same question that the slave girl had asked earlier. You're not one of his disciples also, are you? You see, like the slave girl that had let him in, whoever this individual is, apparently knows that John is one of the disciples. And so he has seen him come in, maybe saw him come in with John. He's not one of them. So are you also one of his disciples? And there again, what does he say? Same response as he'd given the slave girl. I am not. Denial number two. And then that last one, verses 26 and 27. One of the slaves of the high priest, being a relative of the one whose ear Peter cut off, said, did I not see you in the garden with him? Now, John tells us that the third person to challenge Jesus is not only one of the slaves of the high priest, but he also adds this other little detail that he is a relative of the one whose ear Peter cut off, Malchus, that is. So that lets us know that John knows the household of the high priest. He knows who these people are, and he knows how they're connected. He has this detailed knowledge. But this man is standing there by the fire. Maybe, remember, it's a full moon that night. Maybe the addition of the fire there lighting it up even a little bit more. And he was in the garden, and he had seen this individual strike out and cut off the ear of Malchus, one of his relatives. And so now that he sees Peter more clearly, he extends his question. And he asked him, didn't I see you in the garden with him? And for the third time, what does Peter say? Nope, don't know him. Now, what is it that John includes? Immediately, a rooster crows. There are two things that John does not tell us in his account that are found in other accounts that really make this point right here. One of those is found in Luke's gospel. And according to Luke's gospel, this last denial, if you want to look it up, you can look over in chapter 22, right there toward the end, verses 60 and 61. But in Luke's gospel, according to Luke, it's at this exact moment. Remember, they had bound him. Annas had him bound to take over to Caiaphas. They've got to go through the courtyard to get from the residence of Annas to the residence of Caiaphas. And so Jesus is being led across the courtyard. And this is happening at the exact same time that this last question is being put to Peter. And Peter has no sooner gotten the words out of his mouth, the words of denial, than suddenly, at that very moment, as Luke tells us, the rooster crows. And it was at this time, here's what I'm talking about. At this time, what happens? Luke's the only one that records it for us. Jesus turned and looked at Peter. And Peter saw him. Peter, before the rooster crows, you will deny me three times. No. I will die with you, but I will never deny you. Can you imagine what must have gone through his mind in that brief moment of time when their eyes met? And suddenly it all came rushing back. John does not tell us. But Matthew and Luke and Mark do. Matthew and Luke tell us that Jesus went out and wept bitterly. Mark simply says that he went out and wept. Can you blame him? I'll never deny you. Everybody else may, but not me. I'll die with you. Now, as I said earlier, before you condemn him, I want you to remember some things. Peter was the one who protested his loyalty to Jesus in the upper room earlier that evening, before anybody else really said anything. They all chimed in, but it was Peter who spoke first. Peter was the only one, according to any of the gospel accounts, that tried to defend the Lord. The only one that drew a sword. The only one that was going to lash out and try to prevent what was going to happen. Peter is also, though John is the other one that came, Peter also followed Jesus because he wanted to see where he was going and what was going on. Might I suggest to you that what Peter did that evening is what each one of us might do if we find ourselves in similar circumstances, if that were us. He finally gave way to the pressure that he was under. Everything that was going on, he just couldn't take it anymore. Thankfully, Jesus saw what Peter could become and what he would become. A staunch defender of the faith. He even told him, I prayed for you when you have returned. Strengthen your brethren. You know, Jesus saw what Peter could and would become. I believe that he sees what each one of us can and will become if we will trust him. If we will follow him. I think every one of us, you wouldn't be here tonight, would you, if you didn't love him and want to follow him? Would you? You wouldn't be here tonight if you didn't want to be faithful. I want to serve him. I want to be faithful, right? You wouldn't be here tonight if you didn't want to make a difference in the lives of those around you. I want others to know about him. I want them to love him the way I love him. And you wouldn't be here tonight if you didn't want to be with him always. And he knows that about us. But he also knows that we're weak. And there are times that we're going to trip and stumble and fall. There are times that we're going to need others to strengthen us, and that's what he does. There's times we're going to need others to pick us up when we've completely fallen down or fallen away, others to bring us back. And he does that because he loves us. Even when we say, I don't know him, but we really want to. Peter didn't want to mess up that night. He didn't want to fail. He didn't want to deny the Lord. But he did. And yet Jesus still loved him back, just as he'll love each one of us back. So I ask you tonight, have you messed up? Have you failed? Have you tripped up? Do you want a second chance, a third chance, a fourth chance, or who knows how many chances? You know, Jesus said, how many times shall my brother sin against me and I forgive him up until 70 times seven? How many times will God forgive us? As many times as we keep coming back and saying, let me try again. Help me to be better. Help me to be yours. Maybe that's your plea. Maybe you're striving to be the best you can, but you keep messing up. Know that you're not alone. And know that you're not loved. Because he loves you so much that he keeps welcoming you back. But it's up to you to keep saying, I messed up. Can I try again? If you're not a Christian tonight, I want you to know there is no place in all of the world that you will find more love than you will find in the presence of our Lord. And I believe that there's no place that you will find people who care for you more than those who love him as well. If tonight is the night that you need to respond to his invitation, or maybe you just need to come back home as a Christian who's wandered away, we invite you to do so as together we stand and sing.